From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Leaders at the Washington National Cathedral made a controversial decision earlier this month. They voted to do away with Confederate battle flags from the cathedral's stained glass windows. It's one of the latest high-profile stories about the decades-old debate over Confederate symbols like the battle flag. And we'll devote this hour to a discussion of the power of flags as symbols, and the Confederate flag in particular. We'll start with your first thoughts on this simple question. Is it time for the Confederate flag to go?
I feel that the flag, what it represents is not in taste with what America is supposed to be about today. I think it should be changed. It's long overdue.
I just really don't believe if they were absolutely honest about it. It is not there because they're so patriotic. It is there because it symbolizes we should be in control. We were in control when we waved that banner. And we leave that there as a symbol that we want to always be in control, no matter what goes or what comes.
My opinion, I feel like it needs to be decided by the people. The popular vote, kind of like we choose the president and the leader of our nation, I think it all comes down or should come down to the people.
That was Sherry Griffin from Atlanta, Belinda from South Carolina, and Stephen Coley from East Point, Georgia. We'll hear more from them later in the show. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to be clear about my perspective on this issue. I am a mixed-race woman whose ancestors were slaves on a Georgia plantation. I cannot pretend that I'm unbiased on the Confederate battle flag, as the flag is a symbol of torture, oppression, and enslavement to me. However, I'm also a professional journalist, and I welcome an open, honest conversation from all sides on this issue. I don't make public policy. My job is to give you all the information and let you decide as objectively as possible. Today, we'll focus not so much on the debate over the Confederate flag and whether or not it should be flown on government land, but more on the social and cultural implications of it and other flags throughout history. As always, we don't just welcome your comments. We'd love you to enter this conversation with us. So call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Prefer to tweet? We are on Twitter, at OST Talk, or you can leave a message for us on Facebook, and we might feature your comment on the show. A gunman entered an all-black church in Charleston, South Carolina, killing 9 African Americans 1 year ago. The confessed gunman, Dylan Roof, says he was trying to start a race war. Images of Roof with white supremacist and Confederate symbols prompted South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to call for the immediate removal of the Confederate battle flag from the state capitol.
We are here in a moment of unity in our state, without ill will, to say it's time to move the flag from the capitol grounds. Whether it is on the State House grounds or in a museum, the flag will always be a part of the soil of South Carolina. But this is a moment in which we can say that that flag, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state.
The Confederate flag evokes strong emotions, hate or pride. But flags weren't always used as national symbols, and they once served a much more practical purpose. I want to revisit now a conversation I had last year with flag expert Ted Kay and social psychologist Clay Rutledge. I started off with a question to Ted Kay about when flags became so influential.
Well, flags started in China with the development of silk. The first flags appear to have come around 1500 BC. Athens was using them on ships. The Roman army was using flag-like objects. Even the Vikings used flags in the 700s. By the millennium of 1066, the Norman conquest, we see flags on the Bayeux Tapestry. So it was clear by then flags were being used for military purposes. And I think once they were used for military purposes, indeed, they stirred emotions and people had strong connections to flags. But the real strong use of flags began with the Crusades, the Europeans going to the Holy Land to try to liberate it, encountered the Middle Eastern folks who had influence from China, and that's where flags really took off. And I would say that's a key point for emotions and flags to have connected.
Clay, what's the root of their of a flag's emotional power? I assume that they work the same way that a symbol does, say a cross for Christians. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. Take, for example, reading a book. If you've ever been moved by the words in a book, if you've had your feelings stirred by a story that you've read, then you understand the power of symbols, that the symbols themselves aren't particularly meaningful. It's what the ideas that they represent. So a flag, like a piece of art or a cultural icon, such as a crucifix, for instance, is a symbol that isn't something by itself. It's something that represents a broader idea or a cultural worldview.
Do we think of that as a particularly healthy or unhealthy attachment, or is it just natural?
It's natural for humans because humans are intellectual animals who think symbolically. So we're not the only species, for example, that interacts with water, but we're the only species that creates a symbol, H2O, to represent the idea of water. And importantly, we're the only species to turn water into magical powers by blessing it and calling it holy.
I wanted to play a clip for you, Ted. This is Stephen Heller. He wrote a book about the history of the swastika, and he made a comparison between the swastika and the Confederate flag when he was speaking on WNYC.
Once World War II was over, the swastika was labeled contraband. Once the Civil War was over, the Confederate flag or flags were not labeled contraband. In fact, they were retained by most of the Confederate states, and some of them used them in their state flags. The double-edged part of that sword is that once you ban things, it just gives them more life and more electrical charge.
How often, Ted, does the losing side then also lose control over its flag or have that flag banned?
I think it's quite often. I think the great exception is the American South, when the post-Civil War history, which includes Reconstruction and then the abandonment of Reconstruction, where some of the social changes sought by the Civil War took 100 years to change. The delay in those changes, the Civil Rights Act occurring in 1965, 100 years after the Civil War, correlates with the South taking a long time to change its symbols as well.
And we've also tend to have the development of flags as associated with movements. For example, we've been seeing a lot of the gay pride flag, for example, the rainbow flag. Is that a recent development, or have there been flags used often to represent more philosophical ideas or movements?
Flags have represented movements as well as nations, as well as entities, schools, military, sports teams. Movements are just one of many institutions that get represented by flags. I was in Fiji a couple weeks ago helping the National Flag Committee of Fiji work on designs for a new flag for the country. And I identified what flags do on a philosophic basis, and I'd love to compare this with Clay, that flags do many things. They communicate identity. They say, this is us. They distinguish from others, saying we are not them. They show connections, saying we're similar to them. They build commonality within a community. We are together. And they stir emotions, saying this is ours and this is what we believe. That applies to movements, and it applies to the American South, and it applies to countries. All of those functions of flags support what you're talking about.
So, Clay, then let's put this to you as well. Flags, maybe because they are so simple, and that's the power of symbols, that they're uncomplicated messages. You know, for example, the white flag for surrender comes to mean so much more than just that battle token, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we use these symbols as shorthands to represent these larger ideas or as proxies for ideas, or as Ted so eloquently said, to represent group identities, things that we're connected to. And so, yeah, it is a very easy way to represent a whole host of ideas or beliefs or identifications with a symbol.
So who gets to decide the meaning of a flag as a symbol? I mean, the swastika symbol was used in ancient cultures much longer before the Nazis used it. And yet, obviously, that symbol as a symbol of the Nazi regime is the more powerful meaning today. Who ends up deciding that?
Well, go ahead.
I would say it's both. I'll give the short answer and then Clay can elucidate. Both the creators of the symbol can assign meaning to it and often do, but also the users of the symbol assign meaning to it, and that may be meaning beyond or different from what the creators wanted. William Porcher Miles, who helped create the Confederate battle flag, was trying to evoke nationalistic and religious symbolism for the cause of the Confederacy. But people who followed him in the next 10 and 50 and 100 years are assigning other meanings to the Confederate battle flag.
Clay, did you want to elucidate?
I totally agree. I mean, if you think about psychology of association, we often associate any kind of stimuli with something that's powerful. So if when you're a child, if every time you play in your mother's flower bed and, you know, tear up her flowers, she comes out and screams at you, you quickly learn to associate that that's not something you should do. And so the bigger the impact, for example, the Nazi regime, the bigger the association with the symbol, the more people are going to generally recognize it as associated with that. Whether that's in the individual's intention or not, that becomes sort of the cultural knowledge of that association.
So Ted, that brings us back to the Confederate flag. And I have wondered why this particular tragedy has caused people to reconsider the use of the Confederate flag. There have been, sadly, many tragedies before that have not called up this kind of conversation. And I wonder if the fact that this young man walked in and shot 9 people is a strong enough image in people's mind to sort of tarnish the image of the Confederate flag as a flag. What do you think?
I think the reason that these two events have been combined, the shooting and the controversy over the Confederate flag, is that the shooter posed in a Facebook picture with a Confederate flag license plate. And so the Confederate flag was directly connected to the ideology of the shooter. In addition, he posed with a jacket with patches of 2 other flags, the former flag of South Africa and the former flag of Rhodesia, both of which were white supremacist government regimes in Africa. And so his connection to 3 flags, and by showing them connecting the flags to each other, brought the Confederate flag into the debate about the meaning and the impetus to his actions.
That is Ted Kaye. He's a flag expert, also known as a vexillologist. He's author of the book Good Flag, Bad Flag. And we also spoke with Clay Rutledge. He's a social psychologist and a professor at North Dakota State University. Clay and Ted, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You may remember African-American activist Bree Newsom scaling the flagpole of the Capitol building in Charleston, South Carolina, and removing the Confederate flag. Officers were soon on the scene there.
The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? I'm trying to come down, sir. I'm going to comply. I promise you. I'm coming down. I'm prepared to be arrested.
Newsom was arrested along with a white man who assisted her. The Confederate flag was back up within an hour of their arrest. Today's show is dedicated to the culture and power of Confederate symbols like the flag. Let's talk now about legal challenges to flying it. For that, I want to return to a conversation we had last summer with Kathleen Birch of the John Marshall Law School in Atlanta. Charles Bullock also joined us. He's a political science professor at the University of Georgia. Charles began by taking us back to the moment when Georgia changed its flag.
Well, the change came in 1956, which was, of course, just 2 years after Brown v. Board of Education. It was same time as the Montgomery bus boycott, and so the civil rights movement was beginning to heat up. And there have been lots of explanations that have been offered, but the coincidence of timing suggests that this was done as a step to Georgia saying, well, you know, maybe these changes taking place around us, but we're going to hold on to our Confederate heritage.
What was the discussion in terms of keeping the Confederate flag as it is on the Georgia state flag? How did that discussion go in the state house?
You mean when Roy Barnes and first John Miller tried to change it?
Because there's been a number,
it,
yeah.
And then, yeah, that was in about 1992. And then, of course, the flag did get changed about 10 years later with Roy Barnes.
I just want to know how that back and forth went. Do we have an idea about how that argument went? And what were the arguments, both to keep the Confederate symbolism on the flag or to remove it?
Right. Well, the argument for keeping it was that this was not about hatred, not about racism, but instead was a memorial to the Confederacy, to the bravery of the soldiers who fought in it, much like we have the memorial out of Stone Mountain. Showing, well, Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee.
Right, the Confederate memorial, the carving on the rock.
Right,
and
right.
Kathleen, we've heard a lot about what it would take to get the Confederate flag off of the state grounds in South Carolina. Is this normal, this sort of requiring a two-thirds vote of the legislature?
The requirement for the two-thirds vote is not necessarily normal. So most legislation happens by a majority vote. When a legislature wants to sort of bind and make sure that there's no change in the future, then they put in place a supermajority or a two-thirds vote to remove something or to change the law. So a two-thirds requirement is unusual unless the acting legislature wants to maintain whatever the legislation includes.
So our reading of that is that this is something, keeping the Confederate flag at least there on the state grounds was something they did not want to change.
That's correct.
So help me understand, Kathleen, to what extent does a state have complete control over the use, the flying of a Confederate flag or not? Is this something that a federal government can ban?
Well, after the Supreme Court's decision in Walker versus the Sons of the Confederate.
Right, that's on the license plate.
On the license plate case. In that case, the Supreme Court said that when it comes to government speech, the government has complete control over their message. And the only way to change that message would be through the democratic process, which would be by referendum if your state has a referendum, or by changing the legislation. When it comes to whether or not the federal government can make the states engage in a change, then we have to take a look at the federal constitution. And there's nothing in the body of the federal constitution that grants power to either the president or Congress to force the states to change.
I wanted to play you a clip. This is former House Speaker and former Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich on Meet the Press. And I want you to take a listen to this, Charles. He's being asked about Georgia's current flag.
Are you comfortable with the flag the way it is now? You know, it is modeled. It is the original Confederate flag, just with the Georgia seal on it, the way it's modeled.
I think that may well be changed now that people are into a new cycle.
I wonder what you think about that and whether you think Newt Gingrich is right. Do you think there's a possibility that the Georgia flag could be changed once again to remove that Confederate flag?
Well, it's certainly possible, but I think it would take a fair amount of time and a lot of effort to bring about that change, that the Georgia flag doesn't have the symbolism, as your previous guest talked about, associated with it that the Confederate battle flag did. And my hunch is that if we were to go out on the street and do a survey, most Georgians would not recognize the Georgia flag as having some kind of close ties to one of the various flags used by the Confederacy.
And yet, Kathleen, we saw in Germany, at least, they banned the Nazi symbolism. The federal government just said banned, and it's illegal to use those symbols. Is that not something the United States can do?
Well, we have the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is going to restrict Congress, and that also applies to the state. So it restricts our government from how they can regulate speech, particularly when it pertains to viewpoint. So to say we can't have a Confederate symbol at all is viewpoint discrimination, and that would be unconstitutional under our federal constitution.
How fine does that get, though? Say, for example, that the state of Mississippi decides to remove the Confederate flag from its flag, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, okay, the state will not use Confederate symbolism anymore. Then does every county and every city get to decide whether they use it or not?
That would depend on what the Mississippi Constitution itself would say.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, if the Mississippi Constitution provided provided that the state of Mississippi got to regulate what the county symbols were, then there could be some regulation. But if not, then we have to take a look to see what the Mississippi free speech provisions say.
Right.
And when we're talking about government, the state government regulating its constituent parts, so counties and cities.
It gets really complicated.
It can get complicated there because we have to take a look at the structure of government. It becomes as much a structure of government versus speech.
Right.
So it becomes very complicated, and we have to take a look at those state constitutions as well as the federal constitution.
Charles, I know you have probably been aware of the arguments lately that not only about the flag itself, but also in Georgia, Confederate Memorial Day and Robert E. Lee's birthday that are celebrated as state holidays. What are the chances that those kind of things might also change as well? And I wonder if you're just seeing a difference in the debate this time around.
Yeah, I think those might well change. And a lot of this, of course, is all coming about as a result of air conditioning and time. You know, it's a very different state that we live in now than when those events were adopted. I mean, at one point, Tennessee used to celebrate Nathan Bedford Forrest Day. So, you know, if we look across the South, we see that each of the states at some point had one or more Confederate-based holidays, not just the Confederate Memorial Day.
And Bedford Forrest was a lieutenant general in the Confederate Army. And
founder of the Ku Klux Klan.
And brutal, known for brutality. Well, we'll see as the debate moves forward whether or not it's different this time around. I suppose it's different each time. Charles Bullock is a public and international affairs professor with the University of Georgia, and Kathleen Birch is a law professor at Atlanta's John Marshall Law School. Kathleen and Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Confederate battle flag still flies above Georgia state offices, Mississippi state offices, and many other government buildings. But there's another area of public life where the flag appears regularly.
After we put the rebel flag on there and stuck that Dixie horn in there, there couldn't have been nothing more appropriate than General Lee.
That's from the 80s TV series The Dukes of Hazzard. That show was set in the fictional Hazzard County, Georgia. There are other examples in TV, film, music, and art, but not all of them depict the flag in a positive way, especially in recent years. I wanted to learn more about the ways the Confederate flag and related symbols have popped up in pop culture. So I turned to Lakita Bonnett. She's a political science professor at Georgia State University, and she specializes in racial politics and pop culture. I also spoke with Karen Cox. She's a history professor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and she writes the pop culture blog Pop South. Karen, let's go to movies first, since, you know, if you go back to Birth of the Nation, that was one of the real first appearances of the Confederate flag in movies itself. Have we seen the difference in the frequency of the Confederate flag use or in the way that it's treated?
Well, certainly. I mean, in the probably in the first half of the 20th century, the battle flag appeared in several films. Birth of a Nation being one of the first major films, a silent era film, but probably the most successful of all silent era films. And then it appeared in most significantly for a lot of people in Gone with the Wind. But it appeared in movies and numerous movies before Gone with the Wind actually came out. And so in that era, in the first half of the 20th century, you had you would more likely see this in the context of the Old South, in a romanticized Old South. But in the post-civil rights era, you would begin, there would be changes in the ways in which the South is being portrayed in popular culture and in the movies. And you begin to see sort of like a kind of the seedy underbelly of the white South. And as a result of, you know, the civil rights battles and segregationists that we would see on television in our living rooms, and we would, you know, in American living rooms, and we would see that the flag in that context, and it became, it took on a different connotation.
Right. And then we get into music, and for a long time, country music, either rightly or wrongly, has been associated with the Confederate flag and Confederate symbol. But I wanted to play for you, Lakita, this song, Accidental Racist, which was Brad Paisley with help from LL Cool J in 2013. Take a listen.
If you don't judge my new rag, I won't judge your red flag.
Trying to understand what it's
chain.
But not everything we've done.
I'll forget the iron chain.
It ain't like you and me can rewrite history.
So, Lakita, this seems to be an effort to kind of normalize the flag. You have Paisley saying, I'm just a white man coming to you from the Southland, and LL Cool J answers, I won't judge your red flag. What did you take away from that song?
I don't know if necessarily an effort to normalize the Confederate flag. It was, when the song originally came out, it was highly criticized from both parts, from both Paisley and LL Cool J. One is, again, because people were looking at it as being an apology for displaying the Confederate flag, and the LL Cool J verse, as far as hip hop and the authenticity within hip hop, he was not very authentic to the idea, because not only did he say, you know, he was relating a do-rag to a Confederate flag, which one is has a history of being involved in racist acts and or movements, and the other one does not have that history. It was not able, they were not equally equated, right? And then yeah. The second verse where he was talking about, if you do not judge my gold chains, and I'll forget the
iron chains.
Iron chains, right?
Whew.
That was a major, you know, a lot of people really criticized LL Cool J for that verse, because that was saying that, oh, you're going to just forget slavery if I don't judge your chains now. And I understand the effort that they were trying to make. You know, they were trying to equate it, but the way that they used the words and the lyrics that were actually used were really bad on both of their parts, right? Even trying to explain away the flag.
Well, let me play you then a comment from Kanye West, and here he is explaining why he both wears and sells clothing that has the Confederate flag image on it.
You know, the Confederate flag represented slavery in a way, the way my abstract, that's my abstract take on what I know about it, right? So I made the song New Slaves. So I took the Confederate flag and made it my flag. It's my flag now. Now what you gonna do?
So let me go to you, Karen, first for your take on this. Can pop culture reclaim a symbol like that?
I think it's really, really difficult given the long history of that flag and the way that it's been used for ill will, from slavery to the Ku Klux Klan to segregation to the use by neo-Nazis to Dylann Roof in the recent weeks. I mean, it would be really, really hard to appropriate that for any kind of good.
And then, Lakita, let me play for you some comments. Our intern, Kiana Colquitt, went and talked to some people on the street here in Atlanta. And here's their reaction from Sherry and Belinda in South Carolina.
Just by them wearing it, I don't think that's going to turn around the meaning. So the best thing for them to do is not to wear it at all.
That's just like the N-word. I feel that if you're against the N-word, why call each other the N-word? If you're against the Confederate flag and what it stands for, why would you wear it?
And what's your take on that, Lakita?
Well, as far as hip-hop is concerned, and the Kanye West, you know, of course, he is controversial, so he is going to do things a little different. But hip-hop has a history of transforming others' work and making it their own, right? And so the whole idea, even with hip-hop and using samples from other people's music, is an act of transforming. It doesn't always go well. And with the Confederate flag, it is different and partially, potentially harmful because of the legacy and the history of this flag. But hip-hop artists have attempted to try to transform it and to also use it as a symbol of Southern heritage, especially among Southern hip-hop artists. But Kanye West is a little different in the way that he was trying to reappropriate the symbol. But among Southern hip-hop artists, you know, when the
like
South
Outkast
was not...
Out.
Yeah, like Outkast, when the South was not really recognized as being a place of hip-hop, you know, it was mostly the North and the West, and they were trying to assert their place within the hip-hop genre,
uh-huh.
Then they often used flags that represented the South, right? The
yeah.
whole idea of the Dirty South. So they will
right.
use these type of flags, and even when they use them in their music, and in their album covers or in their videos, you will often see not actually an embracement of the flag,
right.
but
right.
just showing that this flag is actually demonstrated, and they
and
were burning the flag, right?
Right.
So
and
it's kind
we'll
of
have
desecration.
To, We'll have to leave it there. That's Lakita Bonnet, who teaches political science at Georgia State University. Karen Cox teaches history at UNC Charlotte. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we focus on the Confederate flag, not on the debate over whether it should be removed from government land, but on our emotional connection to it. And it's not just Southerners who connect to it. Karen Cooper is a Black woman from New York who was once a member of the Nation of Islam. Then she moved to Richmond, Virginia, and began to fly the battle flag.
You know, I'm not advocating slavery. I think that, you know, it was right. It wasn't, and none of my friends think it was. It was just something that happened, and it just didn't happen in the South. It happened worldwide. But yet and still, it's only the Southerners, and it's only the battle flag that has all the weight and the guilt on it, and it's not right. It's not right.
She and many others are profiled in the online documentary series Battle Flag. I spoke with the producers, Logan Jaffe and Zach Sigelko, about their project. Logan started us off by telling me how they got started.
Well, the whole project started when Zach and I actually took a trip to Lexington, Virginia, and we were at the Lee Chapel, which is on the campus there, and there were these Confederate battle flags hanging in the corners of what was a memorial statue of you know, General Robert E. Lee, kind of a on his deathbed, and he's buried underneath the chapel. So when Zach and I visited the place, you know, right when we walked out, we had so many mixed feelings. We were like, is this okay? Is it okay to remember people in this way? What does the use of the Confederate battle flag tell us about the way we as Americans want to remember the Civil War, and what we choose to remember is important about it?
You know, Logan, I understand you started at the, I guess you'd call it a museum in Georgia, with Dent Wildman Myers. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the first person we decided to shoot an interview with and actually profile. But yeah, that was our first stop in this whole journey around parts of the South, and actually around parts of the country, trying to get at what the battle flag means to people on a personal level.
You were here in Georgia and you met Dent Wildman Myers in Kennesaw and his informal museum of memorabilia like Klansmen uniforms. Here he is talking about what people call him.
Racist. Everything in existence is racist if they put that term on it. It doesn't matter what they call me, that's their problem.
Idiot, nut, racist, bigot, redneck, honky.
Hey, you found out my full name. Congratulations. Thank you very much. People just really call me by one of those. But a lot of people come in and they see it as historical. They look at the other stuff as historical. They take consideration that we had a very unpleasant situation in the 1860s.
I wonder, Zach, what your reaction was to Wildman Myers and whether or not he was running a museum or not.
Yeah, I mean, his shop is a really interesting experience. I think I've described it before as visiting a museum on dinosaurs and finding out that the tour guide is a dinosaur. It's a really... For me personally, I took a lot of value out of kind of being in a room with all of these little like knickknacks that showed a side of racism in American history that I had never been exposed to in that way before. It's really shocking. But I think there's also some real value in knowing that the KKK had business cards and a hotline and those little things that just make it much more real.
And then you also spoke with, for your project, two Black law students who were going to Washington and Lee. This is Brandon Hicks and Angelica Hendricks. They fought to get that flag removed from a chapel on campus that's named after Robert E. Lee. And here they are talking about that.
For orientation at WNL, we went through an honor ceremony in Lee Chapel. And I think that's where pretty much all of the students of color had these same feelings.
Disgusted. Yeah. We had to sit in Lee Chapel and hear about how great Lee was. There were Confederate flags in the building at the time, and we had to sign his honor pledge, pledging to be as honorable as Lee is. And I'm like...
And if we refused to sign the pledge, we had to get up and withdraw from the university at that time.
So they decided to fight this whole thing, but then they began receiving death threats on Facebook and other social media places. So here is Angelica Hendricks talking about that.
Death threats... screenshots with our pictures and people requesting to do the job. One of the threats that I got was someone was going to decorate a tree with my body. So that's something that you have to really step back and think about it. So I definitely felt as if people were clinging to the flag more.
Zach, what did you think about that? And I wonder how much of a surprise it was to you that people were willing to threaten really violent death over the removal of the Confederate flag.
I hate to say that I don't think it was that surprising. I think, not that, you know, we want to point to any particular group as being responsible for those threats, but groups like the Virginia Flaggers and like pro-flag groups tend to be kind of reactionary, and they're often going out and protesting when they see a threat to the flag and when they see something that takes the flag down from one place or another. You see, that's when they're kind of, their groundswell comes up.
Well, then let's go to a non-stereotypical person defending the Confederate flag, and we heard from her earlier. This is Karen Cooper talking. She's an African-American woman. She lives in New York City, and she's talking about what the flag means for her.
I actually think that it represents freedom. It represents a people who stood up to tyranny. And by me being out there, I hope that you would see this is not racist. I mean, how can it be racist if I'm out there with them? I'm talking with them, I'm hugging them, you know, I'm conversing with them. These are my best friends that I'm out here with.
Logan, how much nuance is there in this argument or this attachment to the flag as a symbol?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. So Karen Cooper moved down from New York City to Richmond, Virginia, and I think, you know, from her perspective, she saw a lot of kind of institutional racism, and she felt a lot of that when she was living in New York, whether that's neighborhood segregation and whether that has to do with her involvement with the Nation of Islam. So when she moved, and she talks about this a little bit in the documentary, that when she moved down to Richmond, she felt like the races were more together. And, you know, she has very personal political leanings with the Tea Party, and she's a very, you know, radical right-wing conservative. And I think she found a strong friend group within similar people who have those views. So I think, you know, her nuance is that she does have a lot in common with people who are in the Tea Party, and that does have some crossover with the Virginia Flaggers. So, you know, what the flag means to her, it does kind of align, despite race, I guess, from her perspective with this group, and which is why she so strongly advocates for that political view associated with it.
So, Zach, I wonder how you felt about this. You both went into this project already having an opinion on the Confederate flag, did you not?
Sure. I mean, I grew up in Chicago my entire life. I think that it's safe to say that I had a pretty northern perspective on the flag and didn't come to it with any of the associations of Southern pride or whatever. I think that I don't know that our views personally shifted. I mean, so much of what we're trying to get at is why people feel the way they do on a really personal level and the way that it affects their identity. And I don't think that my perception of my identity in the flag has changed. But I do think that I understand more about where different people come from.
And it's surprising the collection, how different the people are that you found that has such strong views. I wanted to play you this comment from someone in Richmond. This is Goat Gatsby, who's an indie rapper and now actively fights the flaggers, the people who support the flag, outside the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, and he rides his tricycle and a sign that says, "Not my flag," and plays rap music. Here he is.
I was walking on my way to work, and I see him all the time on my way to work, and I was talking to my coworkers. I was like, what if I just go there and just play Kanye West? Conservative white people just hate Kanye West, like, for no reason. They just feel like they have to. I went out there, and things got very personal.
Tell me a little bit, Logan, about how personal this is for people and how deeply it's associated with some people's very personal identity.
Yeah, I mean, in Goat Gatsby's case, you know, he has a long line of Confederate ancestry. And one of the things we learned right away with Goat, you know, he goes out there with a sign that says, "Hip hop is my heritage." And, you know, the personal angle to all this is what you consider your heritage and what points of history you are willing to acknowledge and which, you know, what other parts of history you're willing to not really acknowledge and what you consider your own identity. So, I mean, that plays in largely when we're talking about people like Goad Gatsby, who, you know, could be very, you know, just historically and given his ancestry, could be on the other side. He could technically be, you know, involved with the Sons of Confederate Veterans if he wants to. But he's choosing actively to not do that.
So you guys visited Stone Mountain here in Georgia, correct?
Right, yeah.
And did filming there. I wonder, are you aware of the controversy now over the Confederate flags that fly at Stone Mountain Park and the memorial there? You know, they have the Confederate faces
right.
carved mm-hmm. into the mountain. Did you talk to people about that?
Yeah, we talked to somebody who had written a paper about Stone Mountain. It's called The Disneyification of Stone Mountain. And we talked a little bit about his experience there when he used to go there as a kid. And we did see, you know, the Confederate flag displays. And this includes the Confederate battle flag. It includes the American flag, the Stars and Stripes. And it also includes the First National. And, you know, they're all kind of displayed together at the base of the mountain. So that's something that did intrigue us. But as far as, you know, there's been a lot of news to follow about the battle flag. So I'm actually not aware of the recent controversy about the flags at the base of Stone Mountain.
So, Zach, I wonder, you know, we were talking about your feelings over the flag and its use. And I wonder if it changes when you go to a place that was designed as a memorial and whether you have any stirrings of emotion just over this war, the Civil War, and that's part in American history.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we've definitely been talking to a lot of people about is how do we... I think you don't find many people who argue just for all the flags everywhere to be taken down and for no one to see a flag in anywhere. The question is, what is the correct, like... place for a flag. Right. And I think most people do seem to agree that the correct place is in museums, the correct place is in like a really specific memorial setting. And I think I can agree with that. I think that there is value to knowing our history and to not just trying to cover up the bad parts. But I think that it needs to be done in a way that is really, you know,
educational
and recognizes the history. And I think that that's important.
Well, then let me play you two more voices before we end this conversation from your project. The first is Clark Van Buskirk. He was born in Pennsylvania. He lived in New Jersey. He's now in his mid-40s. In his mid-40s, he decided to become a Confederate reenactor. So here he is talking about all the controversy over the flag.
When you see the fight to take the flag down, what's wrong with our country? What's wrong with our people? What's wrong is they don't understand what they're talking about. It was a cause that's lost. We lost. We didn't win. If we won, what would our country be like? It would be stronger and it would be better, in my opinion.
So that is a very controversial view, but it's a stereotypical one of somebody who is a Confederate reenactor, right? He's basically saying he wished the South had won, right, Logan?
Yeah. Well, I would say I'm not sure that I wouldn't say that it's a stereotypical view of a Confederate reenactor. I think, you know, Clark is an interesting character because he has Northern origins. Like you said, he's from Pennsylvania and has lived in New Jersey. but he does have conservative leanings, and he has this kind of romantic view of the South and what the South represents. And I also want to say, too, is that it's interesting because that interview we did with him was recorded a little bit less than a year ago. And just, you know, from following a lot of this, of the news about the flag, I've been looking at some Confederate reenactor Facebook groups, and there's actually a lot of people who, you know, reenacting for the Confederacy or not, who have been, you know, debating this, even in the group. I think that this issue has really brought a lot of people to think a little bit differently about their role as a reenactor and what that might mean to other people and how that might affect people.
Well, to that end, let me play you another comment from your project. This is Michael Lordy, also a Confederate reenactor in the same group as Buskirk that we heard.
To me, you know, the only time I will display a Confederate flag or the only time I ever wear this uniform or do anything, you know, representative of the Confederacy is here. To me, this is how you express the sacrifice and honor the sacrifice of the people who the soldiers from the Confederacy and who fought these battles and what they endured. In the outside world, you know, it's far too sensitive.
Zach, is that a relatively common expression? I mean, that sounds to me like, I mean, if you're doing it only during reenactments, that's almost the same idea as leaving it in museums, is it not?
Yeah, I think it kind of is. Reenacting is obviously a little different than a museum setting, but I do think that when we were talking to the Confederate reenactors, that was a pretty common statement. There were a lot of guys who were very sensitive and aware of the feelings towards the battle flag off of the battlefield when you're not, you know, in a reenacting setting. And right. A lot of reenactors are really able to separate, you know, their outside life from their reenacting life.
That was Zach Sigelko and Logan Jaffe. They're the producers of the online documentary series Battle Flag. You can watch that series at battleflag.us. And that's our show for today. As you know, the conversation with you continues 24/7, though. I know you have thoughts on the Confederate flag. Newt Gingrich says Georgia's flag might change again. So do you think we should remove the Confederate flag from our state flag? Should government entities fly the flag at all, or should that be a personal choice? Be honest and speak up. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also at OST Talk on Twitter and at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.